happen to us is that Jesus should roll into our lives and knock them down and reduce them to dust.
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
Fears. In the normal course of things, I have considered myself pretty blessed not to have a lot of fears. I'm not afraid of heights. I've never been afraid of the dark. I don't have any trouble with claustrophobia and confined spaces, that sort of thing. I can handle bad dogs with the best of them. I have fought hand-to-hand with nests of yellow jackets and wasps and hornets, and I have extinguished lots and lots of those nests, and so far none of them have extinguished me. I've always managed to come out on the top end of that struggle. I'm not afraid of rodents. I'm not afraid of deep water. I'm not particularly afraid of pain. I don't like it, but I can put up with it better than most people. I admit that I don't like spiders very much. But even there, I usually manage to master my irrational fear because I know that they can't really hurt me, at least not as bad as I can generally hurt them. And there is the root of real fear. It is based on the potential probability for harm. We fear things because we think they may hurt us. The greater the potential for harm, the greater the fear. Such was the case with Herod Antipas, the Herod of which Mark read this morning. And I know that the gaggle of Herods in the New Testament can often be confusing. And in another sermon I did, I went through it in more detail, put up a chart and everything, if you guys remember that. I won't do that today, but let me tell you that there are essentially five Herods that you need to remember that come into the New Testament story, and I won't spend real long on this. The first four are real easy to get because it's a father and his three sons. There's Herod the Great, who was the guy with the three wise men and the slaughter of the babies in Bethlehem and all that. And Herod the Great had three sons, that is, three sons who survived his violent paranoid delusions and lived to be adults, and those would be Herod Archelaus, Herod Philip, and Herod Antipas. There's another Herod, but we'll come to him in a little while. When Herod the Great died, the Emperor Augustus put his son Archelaus over about half of his father's former territory, including Judea and Samaria. Archelaus also inherited his father's violent paranoid tendencies, and he was big on executing everybody that he thought constituted any sort of threat to himself, his power, or his security. On one occasion, his biggest single hit, Archelaus executed 3,000 of his citizens at a swipe. Matthew 2:22 tells us that when Mary and Joseph returned from Egypt with the baby Jesus and they understood that Archelaus was ruling in his father's old seat, they thought to themselves, you know, this is a good time to move north, and went up to Nazareth. Kind of hard to find fault with that logic. Herod Philip son of Herod the Great and Cleopatra. Herod had five wives, by the way, and I won't go into all of that. But son of Herod the Great and Cleopatra was given authority over the northeastern portion of his father's holding, places that have unfamiliar names like Oronitis and Trachonitis, which sound a whole lot more like diseases than cities. He was the best of Herod the Great's sons. He was truly interested in helping his people. He had a long, good reign, died in honor about AD 34, too soon. Then there was Herod Antipas, to whom nicknames stuck like sneak and thief. He was given the territory of Galilee and Perea. On a visit to his brother Philip's house, he stole his brother Philip's wife, who was also Philip's and Antipas's niece, Herodias. You get the idea. Herod's name kind of filtered through everybody in those generations. The girl was Herodias. Even though Herod Antipas was already married at the time and he had to put away his wife in order to be married to Herodias, even though Philip was, after all, his brother, Antipas and Herodias just ran off together and they holed up there in Antipas's palace in Galilee and they took Philip's daughter, who would also be, what do you call it, your niece's daughter? Is that your great-niece, great-niece, grand-niece? Would have been Herod Antipas's grand-niece. They took Salome along with them. Now, just about everything that Herod Antipas did was like that. The incident with Herodias was not an isolated incident. He was in the habit of snatching things or people that belonged to others and running back home with them to hoard up in his palace in Galilee. As you might imagine, after a few years of carrying on like that, the number of places that you are welcomed as a visitor just kind of shrinks down. And Herod Antipas naturally became something of a hermit and a recluse there in the stronghold he had built for himself. He did not have any regard for governing the people over whom he was placed. He did not, like his brother Philip, take up any big architectural or development projects. On the other hand, he did not, like his brother Archelaus, murder lots and lots of people. He just took stuff and hoarded it up in his palace. I don't know that even before Herodias, Herod Antipas could ever have really been called happy. Most people in this lifestyle are not. But after Herodias, he certainly became unhappy because Herodias, as much as he thought he wanted her, turned out to be a nag. She always wanted something. And she knew how to get it, how to manipulate and bully and squeeze her weak-charactered husband until he got it for her. The few bridges that Antipas did not burn on his own behalf, he soon burned on Herodias's behalf. A little more on that later. Even if it was not, as the Duck Dynasty folk would say, a happy, happy, happy kingdom, Herod Antipas had built his kingdom, and he hunkered down in it. And then there came this guy who preached that all such unrighteous kingdoms were doomed, and that there was another kingdom coming, a kingdom not only not of this world as it is currently constituted, but inimical to this world as it is currently constituted. And it would smash to bits all these little petty sinful kingdoms. And anybody who had a mind to could get into this new kingdom and be happy. The man's name was John. And Antipas was of two minds. There was this miser's stronghold he had built for himself and which he was loath to surrender. But on the other hand, he was unhappy. And maybe John was right. Maybe his little kingdom was doomed. It certainly was sinful. And maybe there was this other kingdom where a person could become a resident and be happy. Maybe. Maybe those promises were true. Herod Antipas at least wanted to hear John out. He was of two minds. Herodias, however, was of a single mind. She had found her kingdom, she had built her stronghold, and she liked it. All she had to do was put pressure on her weak husband, and she could have just about anything she wanted. And John, of all the unmitigated gall, had said, "Your marriage is wrong. You need to take her back to her husband Philip, who she was so eager to leave because he wouldn't give in and give her anything she wanted. You need to take her back to her husband Philip. You need to reunite with your wife, who you put aside so you could have this woman who was only willing to come with you because your stronger brother wouldn't give in and give her everything she wanted. She's better off there. You're better off without her. This is what God would honor. Get it done." Of all the unmitigated gall. Herodias had her kingdom. And she liked it. And she correctly perceived that John the Baptist was a threat to it. She feared John. And she decided John had to go. Bullied by his wife, Antipas did what was in his nature. He put John in prison, which is to say, he added John to his collection, brought him to the palace where he could keep him there all the time, even if in a cell. And he would go at various times and still hear John preach, because John preached from his prison cell, and John's message never changed, and Herodias's message never changed. It's not good enough to lock the man up. He's still poisoning your mind. He's still putting me at risk. You need to have this man executed. I want him dead. And she was, I will give her this, willing to do whatever it took to get done what she wanted done. She was willing to make the implicit promise to prostitute her daughter to get it done. And I need you to understand something. When Herod Antipas said to Salome, "I will give you whatever you want, even up to half the kingdom," I need you to understand what he was saying to her. "I will put away your mom, like I put away the lady that she replaced, and you can be my queen." Whatever it took. When Antipas heard the preaching of Jesus, it sounded eerily familiar. And he began to be haunted by the thought, "John, whom I had beheaded, has come back from the dead. And he has all these miraculous powers. And boy, am I in trouble." It's quite possible I should have saved this sermon for a few weeks with Halloween coming on. Would have fit in well, but just falls where it fell. In the early portion of his career, the prophet Daniel interpreted a dream for another king named Nebuchadnezzar. The dream was of an enormous statue of varied materials representing a succession of great kingdoms that would, over time, rule over just about the same patch of real estate. And then there was this big stone, not carved by hands, that came rolling in and crashed into the feet of that statue, the feet being made of clay. They shattered. The statue toppled. The stone rolled right on over it. We come to know in time that the dream is ultimately fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ, in whom God's divine kingdom invades the time and the space that all our little petty kingdoms occupy. And he is the rock that rolls over all strongholds and reduces them to rubble. There were several kingdoms operating at the time and place where Jesus made his entrance. The Sadducees had a little kingdom going. They believed, firmly believed, that this life was the only life there would ever be. There was no life hereafter. When you're dead, you're dead. When you're gone, you're gone. So you need to do whatever you're going to do now, get whatever you're going to get now. And so they played ball with whoever had power. In their case at this time, it was Rome. And they would compromise with Rome in order to get wealth and authority and position for themselves. And within the confines of this little kingdom that they built, they had everything they thought they mattered. And then Jesus rolled into their kingdom, preaching an eternal life hereafter. And the Sadducees quickly recognized that if the words of Jesus were taken seriously, the days of their kingdom were over. And so they decided, for the sake of their kingdom, Jesus must go. Pharisees had a little kingdom going. It was different from that of the Sadducees in that the Pharisees believed in the life to come, and they believed that you got there by keeping the law of Moses. Every jot, every tittle of the law, washing your hands at the right time, the right ways, the right place, and picking the little dill seeds off the box on your kitchen window to sort them out so that you gave exactly 1/10 of those seeds as an offering there in the temple. That's how it's done. That's how you get to the life hereafter. And Jesus rolled into their kingdom, preaching that it requires a righteousness greater than that of the Pharisees to make any progress. And it's all about grace. And their kingdom depended on it being all about works. And they knew that if the preaching of Jesus ever caught on, the days of their kingdom were at an end. So enough of them at least decided that for the sake of their kingdom, Jesus must go. And Rome, though Rome's initial crucifixion of Jesus Christ was on behalf of the entreaties of the Jewish authorities, Rome ultimately would take action on its own account. From time to time, among other things, Rome taught that their emperor should be worshipped as a god. And Jesus insisted plainly, there is only one God. All must bow to him and to him alone. And Rome took repeated and drastic action to, if possible, scrub the very name of Jesus Christ completely from the face of the earth, because they knew that if that rock hit their clay feet, the jig was up for their kingdom. Rome failed. Sadducees failed. Pharisees failed. and Jesus rolled on. Now, I could go on in this same theme because there have been many other kingdoms. And Jesus Christ is still the same rolling stone with built-in radar for clay feet. But I need to start drawing this to a close. So 2 points real quickly, and then one final story. Point number one, we should be at least a little encouraged by the hostility that we see toward Christianity in our day. The kingdoms of this world are still built on the same model and still have the same feet of clay. And when they look at Jesus Christ and see that he represents a threat to their little kingdom, to their stronghold, to their continued grip on power, they are entirely correct. Let them bluster. Let them lash out in their fear. The rolling stone will not be stopped. And all such kingdoms will be crushed to dust. Point number two. Aside from nations and states, we all build little kingdoms. The usual word is strongholds. We build them around sin and lust and vanity, and they are generally small and mean and despicable. But they are our kingdoms. And we hunker down in them and we fear their destruction because we are so invested in them. We guard shameful sexual liaisons. We hedge futile fixations with money. We escalate petty tyrannies and cruelties and defend hopeless citadels of dishonesty, not because these things make us happy, which they almost never do, but because on some level we fear that they are all we have. We protect such strongholds with an intense jealousy and all our strength, when the truth is the best thing that could ever happen to us is that Jesus should roll into our lives and knock them down and reduce them to dust to set us free from these horrible, mean, petty little prisons that we have built for ourselves. It's got to be done. Sooner or later, this is a question of kingdoms, and there can only be one king. Herod the Great was in his day given the title of king. Rome gave him that title in exchange for a fairly impressive list of services he had provided the empire. When he died, Rome decided not to confer the title of king on any of his sons. Herod the Great's desire had been that the son who was most like him, Archelaus, should be king after him and have it all. Rome divided it up and gave the territory to his 3 sons and gave them titles like ethnarch and tetrarch, which sound more like video games than offices. I mentioned that Herod Archelaus once executed 3,000 citizens at once. He added to that tally by several smaller executions. Rome wasn't having it. It caused riots and disturbed the peace. After 10 years of bloody excess and refusing to be corrected, Archelaus was recalled and exiled to Gaul, which is France. Only you should know that in those days it was not a tourist destination when it was Gaul. He was sent there to live out his days in misery and poverty. His territory was put under a Roman procurator before long, Pontius Pilate. would hold that seat. With Archelaus gone, certain individuals recognized the possibility of increased territory and maybe even the return of the title of king. Does anybody care to guess what individual more than any other recognized and sought after those possibilities? Hint, it starts with an H. H-E-R-O-D-I-A-S. Herodias saw the possibility of enlarged territory and perhaps even the return of the title of king to her weak charactered husband, from whom she could get anything she wanted. And so she undertook a campaign of nagging and bullying until Herod Antipas finally gave in and left his palace for the first time in a long time and went to Rome to see if he could acquire his banished brother's territory and increase his own title. Remember, I told you there was a fifth Herod in the New Testament. That would be Herod Agrippa I, the son of Aristobulus, who was married to Herod the Great's sister, Bernice. So he was a first cousin to the other three Herods. He also, Herod Agrippa, married another cousin who was the daughter of an aunt who married her own uncle. You figure it out. Point was, Herod Agrippa didn't want Herod Antipas to take over the territories of Herod Archelaus or to have the title of king. So when he heard that Antipas was headed with Rome, he went to and he took with him something he had been preparing for a long time, a big, thick portfolio that listed all the crimes and moral low ground that Herod Antipas had ever covered and some that he was planning yet to cover, many of which supported the charge of treason. Instead of an enlarged territory and a grander title, Antipas got to join his brother Archelaus in exile in Gaul before the Riviera was built up in that locale. Guess who got to go with him? Guess. Well, Herodias also got to retire in poverty and misery in Gaul. Of all the Herods, Antipas had the most personal encounter with the preaching of John and of Jesus. And he flirted with really hearing it. Oh, had he invited that rolling stone to crash into his feet of clay and knock down his miserable little kingdom. How different things might have been. Don't let this happen to you. The best thing for any of us is that Jesus Christ rolls into our lives and reduces our strongholds to rubble and dust. Because then we will realize that it was a prison all along. And we have been set free.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.